Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Patrick Lannan of the Lannan Foundation about a new series sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. Right now, I'm delighted to welcome to the program Severine von Charner Fleming. She is founder of the nonprofit organization The Greenhorns, whose mission is to support young farmers in the U.S., and she has a new documentary, also called The Greenhorns, which will be screening as part of the Kivira Coalition's Wild and Scenic Film Festival, which is this Thursday, the 3rd of March at 6:30 at the James A. Little Theater in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So The Greenhorns, it's all about new farmers. What is your own background in farming? How did you get into this whole concept of new greenhorn farmers?
Well, I am, in fact, myself a young farmer, a beginning farmer. I think I've farmed now for 7 seasons, and according to the USDA, that makes me a beginning farmer.
Now, did you grow up farming yourself?
I grew up spending summers on my mother's family farm and fell in love with being outside and adventuring around the fields and the farm, spending time with animals and drinking good milk. So I think once you get in it, you tend to get hooked. And that's been our experience with other young farmers is, you know, if they do it for one season, in all likelihood, they'll stick with it.
The mentality of the new farmers, at least as you portray in your documentary, seems to be all about healthy, organic farming. And one of the things that so many people are concerned about is depleted soils, pesticides, basically eating food that's bad for you. How has this change come about? I mean, they haven't necessarily learned this from their parents, if their parents were farmers.
Well, many of us who are coming into farming from a kind of non-farming background, either we're kids from the city or kids from the suburbs, for many of us, the motivation to grow sustainably and to grow food that is free of sprays and poisons is very strong. And in order to make it in farming, you know, you do have to be quite motivated. It is a challenge to overcome all the many obstacles that present themselves in your kind of professional pathway towards being a farmer. And that motivation sticks with you throughout. It's also from a business point of view, sustainable ag and organic farming do offer a very inviting business opportunity for new growers. If you haven't got thousands and thousands of dollars or even hundreds of thousands of dollars to get started, the less inputs you have to buy, the better. So organic gardening, although there's a lot of work involved in managing organic compost and managing weeds, etc., the return on your investment is actually a lot better. And so it's a really practical way to get into farming with less startup costs.
It seems that basically these folks are substituting the power of their own bodies for the power of machines and chemicals, basically.
Yes, indeed. And very much if you're starting small, and, you know, we know what organically means in terms of less inputs and less poisons, but we also grow up our businesses organically. And so we start small and grow them, and hopefully grow them fast enough to be able to support our family and our children when we get to that point. But yes, very much starting at a human scale.
It's interesting because some of the people are children of farmers who left and said, I don't want to have any part of this. In fact, we had a guy on this show not too long ago named Eric Herm, who kind of fits this same model of somebody who grew up on a farm, learned farming, said, I do not want to do this, went out, got an education, learned other things, and then came back to the farm. And there's quite a number of those in your film. What draws them back?
Well, it's good. Yeah, it's amazing what people go off and study. farm kids who leave the farm and they go off and study physics or urban planning or all sorts of other fields, sound design. I just interviewed a wonderful farmer in the Willamette Valley of Oregon who went off to be a sound designer for about 10 years before returning home. I think it's a challenge, watching your family struggle and seeing how locked in a farm operation can get. Not only the kind of political context for the way that farming has been heading for the last 40 years, but also, you know, trying to take over an operation that's governed by the instincts of your family. So I think that distance is probably really healthy to go away and learn something and come back with a new perspective and have that older generation hand over the farm willingly. You know, probably happens 10 years out.
Let's talk for a moment about the political context. You, in your film, go back to the ideas of our founding fathers, including Thomas Jefferson, who understood that the small farmer was the backbone of democracy. We've come a very long way from then, perhaps not in the right direction. What, at this point in history, is U.S. policy toward farmers?
Well, it's a bit complicated, and it's hard to have a streamlined story in film and in general, but agriculture obviously is very complicated. One thing that's not complicated is the role of the independent producer in establishing a grounding for the kind of American politics. So I think what hasn't changed from then till now is the really critical importance of having independent, place-based, committed citizenry. And farming really provides that, because when you're a farmer, you are there. You are committed to that place. You're outdoors in that place every day, and you are a steward of that farm and that water and that community, which is very different from the kinds of transients and the the problem of working for the man. I think that a lot of us are attracted to farming exactly because it's a way to make a living that's honest and direct, and that doesn't come with a lot of the politics that we don't share. It doesn't come with working for a corporation, basically. So I would say that what hasn't changed is the care of place and the commitment to place, and how an independent-mindedness is a very positive force for the long-term health of our society and our economy.
At the same time, for the last, 30, 40 years, U.S. agricultural policy has changed to favor big industrial farms, and it's been very, very hard for small farmers. What is the nature of that policy change, and what are the reasons behind it?
Well, you know, we should continue to question our leadership as to their what's guiding these policies. Certainly the need to or the desire to export our overproduction overseas has been an incredibly powerful driving force. But it's coming to become more obvious, I think, to many people in our society, and hopefully soon to our leadership, that a local food economy and regional self-reliance, a situation in which regions are specializing where appropriate, but where a majority of the fruits and vegetables particularly are grown close to where they're consumed, that's also something we should be aiming our policy towards. That's a kind of a sensible homeland security idea that really deserves attention, and it also deserves institutional support. So the kind of metapolitics or global politics of overproducing corn and wheat and soybeans in order to export them to the world, I think needs to be balanced by a more regional perspective and a kind of more inward-looking perspective of our kids are getting fat and unhealthy on this diet that we've got them on, and in order to feed them properly, we're going to need a lot more locally oriented farms, and vegetables and fruits are, in fact, quite labor-intensive to produce, and that also answers this need we have for more jobs. So in that sense, farms that are oriented towards local production and feeding the community that surrounds them do seem to meet a lot of the goals that we, as a nation, have.
Yeah, it is quite extraordinary when you talk about health and jobs and food security. All of those things are met by and also keeping our soil and farmland sustainable, which large farms tend not to do. Industrial farms tend not to do. Basically, as you talk about at the end of your film, it fills so many. It addresses so many of the problems that we're facing in our nation today.
Well, and we're really motivated to do it is the thing. You know, not only does it make sense, but it's also incredibly compelling as a life, and the leadership that's emerging within our generation to tackle the business startup, be it small grains or pastured poultry. Obviously, the CSA movement is just exploding. We're also starting mills, forming new institutions of support. The extent to which we seem to be ambitious, not only from a farm perspective, but also from an institutional perspective, I think speaks to how much this resonates with us personally. And, you know, at a time when there's a competition to become a butcher in all the cool hip cities and competition to be, you know, a bartender in all the cool hip restaurants, agriculture really offers an opportunity for genuine leadership. And there's so much work to be done and so many new enterprises to set up. I feel like in a time when America really does need a lot of change makers, ag offers a really great place to make that change.
Do you see people studying agriculture in college more than they did, say, 10 years ago?
Well, unfortunately, we have not that much statistical basis for commentary. Greenhorns, which is my nonprofit organization, we have a project called Serve Your Country Food. It's an online map that gathers demographic information about young farmers. Unfortunately, you know, it takes many thousands of data points in order to have a real conclusion. What I can say is that the number of English majors and anthropology majors is quite high, and a lot of folks also come to farming from an environmental science background, ecology, biology, etc. Those are the kinds of people who are attracted to plants and animals.
It's very encouraging because one of the, I think, problems in farming and ranching is that there are people who say, well, this is the way we've always done it and we're not going to change, even when the way that it's being done is not good for the land or good for the people who eat the food. And this is a whole new model, which also addresses this issue of the fact that the average age of the farmer right now is 57.
Yeah, I think, we have the opportunity to question a lot of the status quo, and we, in fact, have the responsibility to question a lot of these prevailing narratives about, you know, the impossibility of making a life in farming. I think that we do that most profoundly, and we can gain confidence really in a new way because of these technologies that we have today and the social networking that we can do in the digital sphere. So, you know, Greenhorns has been, you know, of necessity, really focused on the online platforms for farmer-to-farmer networking and kind of shared storytelling. We take confidence from each other and from knowing the stories of our peers in other regions, knowing the struggles that we face are normal struggles. The struggle of convincing our parents that this is the right thing, the struggle of convincing our peers and partners, raising capital to get equipment, finding land, getting the right training and, you know, finding the right apprenticeships. These are very common narratives, and when we don't have to fight those fights in isolation, it can give us the confidence to you know, pursue our dreams and make that dream farm come true. So I would say that sharing has been a really core need of the young farming community, and one that continues to swell as we have yet more young energy entering into this field.
We're talking to Severine Foncharner Fleming about her film and her organization called The Greenhorns. There was something that went by kind of quickly in the film, but which I found really fascinating, which is you have kind of a little visual of the kind of inputs and outputs of a conventional farm, and then an organic farm, and then a biodynamic farm. And basically, in a conventional farm, you need pesticides and machines and diesel fuel and so on, and the output is food. And in the organic farm, you still need diesel and machines, but you need fewer inputs, and the output is food and compost. In the biodynamic farm, basically everything goes out. How does that work?
Yeah, so biodynamic farming started in the 1920s in Germany, and it's increasing in popularity around the world, really. In a biodynamic system, the fertility is maintained within the farming organism. And what that means, ultimately, is that there is less purchased inputs and less energy inputs. So what's super positive about that is that we're kind of in a situation on the whole with farming now where we're spending 9 units of energy to get 1 unit of food. And that's the kind of general equation in American agriculture. We're shipping food 1,500 miles from farm to plate these days. We're wasting up to 40% of the food that's grown in pre-consumer waste. So the amount of energy that we're wasting and the amount of energy that we're spending to make the food that we eat really is deeply unsustainable. And I think as the price of oil becomes a factor, that these less energy-intensive production systems will become the norm, and those of us who adopt these systems will really have an advantage. And so, you know, the kinds of capital that it takes and the kind of energy that it takes to establish, for instance, a CAFO system, a confined animal feeding operation, you know, you're talking about a $1 million facility that's air conditioned in the summer and kept warm in the winter. That's those are some bills that young farmers are not really necessarily going to want to pay. And it's for that reason that the pasture-based model of pigs on pasture and in manure, you know, keeping the manure in a hay pack over winter and then keeping that manure as a resource for your farm is such an attractive option compared to, you know, seeing so many inputs and then manure as a waste output that has to be disposed of as a, you know, toxic byproduct of your pork. So it's these kinds of systems that we're interested in, the innovation and the scale of fertility management and reducing our reliance on, you know, basically gasoline energy.
Now, when you have a biodynamic farm, does that mean, by definition, you're raising plants and animals, and the animal manure fertilizes the plant, or how does it work? I mean, specifically, what does it look like?
Well, it's much longer than we could probably talk about here to really fully understand biodynamics, but the basic principles are quite simple, and they're very similar to organic. So there are no synthetics used on the farm operation, and there is a deep reverence for the microbial life of the soil. And that microbial life of the soil is nurtured by using preparations. These are preparations that are prepared seasonally using parts of animals. So, you know, the kind of classic examples are the horn of the cow, which is stuffed with the manure of the cow and buried underground for a year. That makes the preparation. Also, the intestines are stuffed with chamomile blossoms and buried underground. And so, you know, it's a little bit like voodoo, these procedures that you go through to make these preparations. But essentially, you're culturing microorganisms, which you then disperse through your farm system. Some of the preparations you sprinkle on the field. Some of them you put into the compost pile. Some of them are sprayed onto the leaves, and they are all acting as inoculants for the microbial ecosystem of your farm. And of course, this is basically soil science, but it's coming from a kind of traditional practice that's evolved, but largely defined by Rudolf Steiner in his lectures in 1924. So as we start to learn more in the scientific community about the incredible importance of our soil ecology and how that soil ecology translates into higher nutritional density in the food and the life and vitality and disease resistance of our plants, a lot of this stuff will be easier to appreciate in kind of modern scientific terms. And in fact, that's happening already. There's a thing called the Soil Food Web and the Rodale Institute. Those are both kind of more science-driven aspects of the same kind of knowledge, which is based on, you know, traditional farmers' knowledge.
And then when you're talking about the general public who has been educated to look for things that are sterile and pristine because microorganisms might be dangerous and might kill you, there's kind of a paradigm shift that the rest of us have to go through in order to really understand the benefits of what you're talking about.
Well, that's definitely true, and I think that we're in a little bit of a crash course right now in terms of consumer literacy about agricultural issues. You know, there's so many food scares and, you know, crises, you know, in the price of food stuff, in the contamination that's being perpetuated by some of these big players and huge distribution networks that, you know, make an egg poisoning happen in 13 states simultaneously. You know, we're getting a lot of things thrown at us, we the eating public, I mean, in a very quick, it's really every week there's another thing to learn about. And, you know, GMO alfalfa just came out a couple weeks ago. And, yeah, I think that the learning curve has to keep getting steep and steeper because we have become so alienated from the basic ecology and kind of logistics of our food production. And we need to reduce that distance and reconnect with what it takes to make healthy food.
What kind of public policy would be most helpful to production of healthy food, small-scale local farming, and helping young farmers?
Good question, and I really hope that many policy makers are asking themselves how to achieve those exact goals. Clearly, new and beginning farmers are a part of that solution, and so the support of those players in the food system is critical. Another thing that's important is that our land-grant universities serve the role that they were established to provide, and that is to research agriculture and create solutions for agriculture, and particularly helping farmers fight with the diseases that come, learn how to manage their farms for best soil health, figure out the logistics of processing and interregionally, etc. And the funding in our public university system, in our land grant system, has been skewed, unfortunately, over the last three decades especially, has been skewed towards the outcomes and needs of much larger scale agriculture over the needs of smaller and regional scale agriculture. And there are programs that do exist that serve beginning farmers, that serve sustainable agriculture. NRCS has great projects. SARE program is wonderful. The small farms programs are really powerful examples of that work. But it's really a very small percentage of the overall funding that's spent on organic research and training. So that's a big one to start with.
Yeah,
education.
Yeah. And it's something that this very savvy entrepreneurial group of young people, I mean, your generation in your 20s and 30s, seem to be really very actively pushing for. In terms of making the business of smaller scale farming work, what are the outlets? In other words, you talked about CSA, community-supported agriculture. Who else are the markets for this product that can really make a smaller farm viable?
Well, it's a great question, and yes, the CSA model has been tremendous. Obviously, wherever there are foodies, there are restaurants to serve them, and restaurants are great because they'll just buy cases of things. You know, they're fussy and they want it early in the morning, but they will move through a lot of produce. So restaurants are important clients. Farmers markets are obviously a wonderful place to build community as well as a strong membership for your farm of consumers and eaters. Also, an important thing to consider is the powerful consuming force of institutions. We're talking schools, hospitals, elderly homes. We're talking about hospitals, but hospitals are really important places for people to be eating good, nutritious food. And those are also institutions that buy a lot of produce, and they have a very regular appetite for vegetables and products. So I think that as we move forward and as some of the kind of farmers market scenes get saturated, the institutional purchasing will become even more important. And figuring out how those processing, the pre-washing and the bunching and the pre-processing to make that food usable by those institutional kitchens, to make sure that the regulations governing those purchases are as smooth as possible, so that, you know, we, as we grow our farming operations, can start moving not just one case of kale, but, you know, 10 and 15 cases of kale to our local eaters and hospital residents.
It's notable that the big natural food store chains are not really on board with the kind of thinking that you're talking about.
I think they are on board. I think that, you know, the real struggle in every situation is this, that whenever you have man hours being spent organizing logistics and coordinating deliveries, you know, the cost to the consumer is going to go up. And so the advantage for the small farmer or even the medium scale farmer of selling that produce directly and with as few middlemen as possible is quite compelling. And, you know, we're talking about a 20% difference as soon as there's a distribution force involved. Having said that, doing all of the marketing yourself is quite wearing. And so what generally happens is people are selling directly for the first few years of their business to make sure they maximize their return for that product that they've so carefully grown. And as they are able to raise capital and buy infrastructure and scale their operation up so that they can afford to grow more and have the equipment to grow more, then it starts to become more interesting to work with a distributor. So really the answer changes over time. The answer changes according to scale. The answer changes depending on how far away you are from that market. And as you have babies to feed or you decide to focus more on animals who need you there, I think every farmer has to find out for themselves what makes business sense. But the grocery stores are interested in buying local food. It comes down to price point. It comes down to accessibility. It comes down to a coordination time. And I think all of those things, you know, need our attention. And as a grocery shopper, you know, make sure your market knows how much you value that local product, and give them a hard time if they haven't got any, I would say.
Well, there's the local product, and then there's also the issue that some of them, like I believe Whole Foods, is unwilling to stand up against GMOs. They take the side of Monsanto. Trader Joe's, which is a wonderful store, they ship things in from thousands of miles away. And for example, in Santa Fe, the one grocery store that really sells local is the locally owned co-op supermarket.
Well, obviously, if the problem in our food system is too much consolidation, too much vertical integration, and, you know, big bullies of grocery stores, then the answer is more smaller, newer, and, you know, just more numerous options. So I feel like, you know, supporting the independents is a way to vote for that food system that we want. And I think we should continue as consumers to demand, if what we're interested in is sustainable agriculture, then that agriculture translates into sustainable food, then we need there to be sustainable practices at all levels of the food system. And so, you know, push back and let your grocery store know what you feel and make sure that they're doing their utmost to be sustainable in their practices and in the decisions that they're making on how they run their business. Because, you know, we as farmers are having to innovate constantly and learn as much as we can on how to improve the sustainability of our farming practice. Those grocery stores also should be continually innovating, continually figuring out the best way to save energy and perform under the conditions of a changing planet.
Severine von Scharner Fleming is founder of the nonprofit organization The Greenhorns, which can be found on the web at thegreenhorns.net. And her new documentary is also called The Greenhorns, and it's screening as part of the Kivira Coalition's Wild and Scenic Film Festival this Thursday, the 3rd of March at 6:30 at the James A. Little Theater in Santa Fe. And the kickoff address will be given by Santa Fe's own Jack Leffler, who is just a wonderful environmental writer and activist and radio producer, so he'll be there as well. You can go to kiviracoalition.org to find out more. Severine, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Such a pleasure, and thank you all for encouraging the young people in your own lives to tune in, turn on, and get farming.
Excellent. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm delighted now to welcome Patrick Lannan. He is president of the Lannan Foundation, which is based right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, and it's very nice to be here, to be on your show.
So the Lannan Foundation, which probably most of our listeners know from the Readings and Conversations series, which happens on Wednesday nights, many Wednesdays of the year at the Lenzik Performing Arts Center, you are now adding a new series, a new public lecture series that's going to be on mostly on Tuesdays called In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom, a lecture series on political, economic, environmental, and human rights issues. What's it all about? Well, that sentence kind of says it, but what's the motivation for it?
Well, I think we've come to the conclusion that time is right for a series that addresses the critical issues that we're facing as a species on this planet. And they're political, they're economic, they're environmental. There are issues that have to do with our rights under the Constitution, our rights of privacy. And collectively, we just feel that we're in a critical stage and a critical time, and we've already have a lot of evidence from our Readings and Conversation series that there's real interest in these kind of issues in this community. We've been doing our Readings and Conversation series since 1998, and during that period, we've had 26 to 30 people you'd normally qualify to be in this new series in Pursuit of Cultural Freedom. Everybody from Gore Vidal to Noam Chomsky to Arundhati Roy to Howard Zinn to Lewis Lapham, you know, David Suzuki. So I think that we feel we need to have kind of a separate strain, separate track, a separate place to do the events, most of them, though a few may still be at the Lenzik, but most of them will be at the School of the Deaf, which is...
Yeah, the wonderful James A. Little Theater over there.
Right, which is has a little bit less seating, and we think we can get a little more compression there and a little more excitement, because we're going to bring some people in who wouldn't normally, almost nobody in the community might at first blush be familiar with, but I think hopefully they'll trust us based on our performance to date, that we're going to bring in interesting, thoughtful people and have them give talks, not readings, and also take some questions through written questions from the audience. There will be someone to introduce them and to also interact with the questions from the audience and provide commentary and conversation after the event. We're also going to videotape them, and then we're going to make them available to be downloaded from our website. And they can be used for any purpose, really. We want to disseminate this information as widely as possible.
So the first one is going to be on the 8th of March with Glenn Greenwald. Who is he and how did you choose him?
Well, Glenn Greenwald is a former constitutional lawyer who began writing several years ago on Salon.com. And he writes a lot about civil rights and community rights issues. But he also writes about foreign policy issues. He's a very, very smart guy, and he's a good writer. He's also a good speaker, and we're hoping that when we bring him here, we're going to talk that he's going to talk a lot about this whole WikiLeaks thing, about the right of the public to know what their government is doing, and we think it'll be a really interesting evening. And we're going to have him interact with David Barsamian, who I think is fairly well known in this community. He's spoken here in the past, and he's been involved with us at events and readings and conversations. So that's our opening.
Yeah, David Barsamian, who's the host of Alternative Radio, which airs right here on KSFR, and also KUNM.
Yeah, correct. And he's very good. He's very smart. And so we think it'll be an interesting evening. I think the things that Glenn writes about in Salon.com, I hope people will go to the website before they show up at our event on March 8th. Because I think they'll find his work is really interesting. He writes almost every day. I don't know how he does it all.
Yeah. You said a moment ago that some of the people, although they're very famous in their field, might not be household names for people in the community. With readings and conversations, it's the same thing. Many of the people are very famous and known to everybody. Others are not. Do you have people coming having no idea what they're going to get, but they come anyway because it's a Lannan event?
I think... Yes, we do. I mean, and I think in a sense we do kind of look at each season as in order to draw people in over the whole season, we always try and put a few readers in there who are really widely known and will surely get interest in the series in general. But I think there are plenty of people in town who just trust us now. We bring in some poet they've never heard of, like B.H. Fairchild, and we don't fill the Lensic, but we still get... 350 people, and I bring that up only because he turned out to give one of the best poetry readings anybody had ever been to, and I think probably more than half the people there had never heard of him, never knew, you know, what he was like.
Right.
So, we hope that we can do that here, and particularly that maybe they'll just trust us going in because of the readings and conversation series.
Now, the next person is Maria Hinojosa, who is with NPR's Latino USA, and she's been around doing journalism for a really long time.
Right. I mean, I think in this community she's going to be widely known, and we expect to have a big turnout. And in fact, obviously you know, we've invited you to be the host that night. And
yes, ladies and gentlemen, I will be the host that night.
Right. So I think that should be, and I think border issues in this state and with this new governor and everything that's going on here are really among the critical issues that I probably should have mentioned earlier, but so we've wanted to get right to it.
So what are, Patrick Lannan, some of the issues that really motivate you and that are close to your heart and that you want to bring to the public?
Well, environmental issues, I think, are really, I think as a species, we're at a point where if we can't turn the ship in the next 5 years or so, begin to really turn it, I think we're in big trouble. And yet the mass media in the United States really doesn't do even close to an adequate job of explaining how critical the situation is. And so I'd say that. I think privacy issues, civil rights issues, I think they're critical. And I think we're going to have a number of speakers on dealing with the subject of economics. Economics as it affects the environment. We're going to bring in someone who's what they call a no-growth economist. We're going to bring in someone...
Very interesting. Steady-state economics.
Yeah. That's going to have to be the economics of the future at some point, because we can't continue to live in a world where the only economic solution to every problem is more growth and more consumption.
It's so true. I've been following, actually, steady-state economics as a theory since the 1980s, and nobody ever talks about it. It's as if it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, one person we might bring in is Herman Daly, who was one time the chief economist for the World Bank, and he's become one of the leading spokesmen for this theory of environmental economics. We're going to bring in Richard Wolff, who's a retired professor from UMass, who still lectures at the New School in New York and also at the Goethe Institute in New York. And he has a book, I have it right here, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. and he's a great lecturer, and he really does a scathing indictment or analysis of the economic models that are now popular, and from neoliberalism to Keynesianism, and so he has another perspective. So we think that'll be an interesting event. We're going to bring him hopefully next fall, but so I think those are among the issues. The militarization of our foreign policy, which is bankrupting the country.
Right.
You know, we've had Chalmers Johnson here and Andrew Bacevic, and we can't obviously bring Chalmers back. He recently died, but, it doesn't mean we couldn't bring Andrew Bacevic back in a year, but it'll be part of this series and not the Regency Conversation series.
So this is, with I think one exception so far, it's going to be mostly on Tuesday nights. The Maria Hinojosa will probably be on a Monday night, but other than that...
Because of her schedule, yeah.
Because of her schedule, right. So another night a week that people can kind of stick in their calendars. Now, people might not know that the Lannan Foundation, besides the readings and conversations, has all kinds of other programs. What are some of the other things that you do?
Well, we still have an art program. We still buy some art, which we always intend to give to institutions. Most of the art collection we had at one time we gave away a number of years ago.
To museums?
All to museums, all to nonprofits. We've got quite a bit of art on loan at the Dia Center for the Arts Museum in Beacon, New York. We're very much involved in a project in Nevada that we have been involved for about 20 years almost, called the City Complex, which is Michael Heiser is the artist. And that's nearing completion, I think, within 2 or 3 years. We still make some grants to museums for exhibitions, to nonprofits. Obviously, the program isn't as large as it was. And then we have a literary program. Well, that's Readings and Conversations part of that. We also have a residency program in Marfa, Texas. We can have 4 writers at a time. We own 5 houses there.
And so you basically give a writer a house and let them write a book.
And they can stay for a month to 3 months.
Who are some of the people that you've had who we might have heard of?
There's so many, you kind of stumped me in a way. I'm going to have to take a break on that.
Yeah. Let me.
Deborah Eisenberg is for example, a writer in residence there right now. In fact, Wally Shawn's down there with her right now.
Wally Shawn, the actor?
Yeah. And they've been there together in our residency program before. John DeGatta, who just spoke here.
At the Lenzig recently, yeah.
Ben Marcus, who interviewed him, was just there.
Dar Jamal.
Dar Jamal. And trying to think.
But a lot of people who have written books, and it's a wonderful thing. It gives people an opportunity to just quiet down and not have to have a day job, basically, while they finish their book.
Well, we have a really lovely, they're beautiful houses, and they're completely on their own. We provide transportation, and we give them a monthly stipend, and that's it. And they really have to do anything except just write us a little letter when they leave, because it is technically a fellowship. But, they can go down there and really do virtually nothing.
Now, you have an Indigenous Communities program as well.
That's correct. That's one of our biggest programs. And the program that really started up when we cut back on our art program, our visual arts program. And most recently, we prevailed, after about 10, 11 years of funding, we prevailed in the largest trust community trust case against the United States government brought by Eloise Cobell and 300,000 plaintiffs for the Department of Interior's mismanagement of Indian trust funds for over 100 years.
Very interesting.
And while the Indians didn't get a fair settlement, they got over $4.5 billion settlement.
Billion.
Billion. And that was something we were involved in and funded. It couldn't have happened without our support. And we were there for, 11 years from the time we met Eloise Cobell. And that's going to be paid out hopefully this August. And that's a precedent-setting case for Indian rights versus the way the government's treated them for years. But we fund immersion language from Hawaii to the rural Hawaiians to the Mohawk Indians in upstate New York, Blackfeet tribe in Montana. We fund environmental cases in Indian Country. We're now taking on a case. We fund legal work in Indian Country. That's really rare because it can be very expensive. Most recently, we've gotten involved with the Goshute Indian tribe who are on the Utah-Nevada border and are threatened by the fact that the city of Las Vegas wants to run a pipeline 500 miles up into the Great Basin along the Utah border and take the water, the groundwater, and pump it back into Las Vegas, which would turn the Great Basin into a dust bowl. And we're involved, and there are a lot of other people, a lot of other plaintiffs that are going to be involved in this fight, but it's the kind of thing that we're prone to do in Indian Country. We also provided the funding in California for the first indigenous-run state park, effectively public park in the United States, probably one of the first ones in the world, called the Sinkyon Wilderness Park, which is right next to the Sinkyon State Park in Northern California. And we continue to fund the reclamation work, and it's a restoration project as much as anything. So, yeah, we do a lot in Indian Country. We also have a cultural freedom program, and of course that's where this series comes out of. And that we fund a range of things. Probably the most well-known thing we fund, and we're the major funder of Democracy Now!, which is carried on KSFR, of course.
Indeed, twice a day.
Yeah, and we think it's probably in that area, cultural freedom is good as anything we've been able to do.
How did you get into this work?
I backed him. I'm a Lannan. I was in the foundation was started by my father. It was really endowed in 1985, but basically there was no real plan for it. There was some tradition in the family, art, literature, and family got together, and there weren't many candidates, and they voted me in. And so I can't say I earned the job, but I've been doing it now for, this is my 26th year, and the foundation really started when I went to work there.
Now, Readings and Conversations has been going on for what, over 20 years?
20 years. Started in Los Angeles.
And it's been in Santa Fe for, what, 13, 14 years?
Yeah. The first event that we ever did was with Michael Silverblatt was the host.
Bookworm.
And we started off, we gave it with a bang, because we had Seamus Heaney. So we had Seamus Heaney and
that was your
Michael
first event?
That was our first event. Our first event here was Czeslaw Milosz with Helen Vendler. So we started off with two Nobel Prize winners.
Amazing. And yeah. Seamus Heaney bought his first pair of nice shoes, and the price tag was still on them.
No, that was Michael Silverblatt. he was a radio person, so he wasn't used to being out in the where you could see him. And he crossed his leg, and there was the price tag on the sole of the shoe. It was a great moment.
Yes, we radio people can be sartorially challenged. So In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom is a lecture series that's coming up, sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. And once again, the very first event is Tuesday, the 8th of March, with Glenn Greenwald and David Barsamyan. So people can look forward to that. It's going to be at the James A. Little Theater, as are all the events in the near future.
In the near future, yeah. And I think we should mention that on, we mentioned Maria on April 4th.
Maria Hinojosa of NPR, Latino USA.
And then Michael Ratner, who you're also going to be the host for.
Yes.
The attorney and president of the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights. And I talk about someone who's doing great work and a great organization. So he's going to be here. So those will be the three events before summer.
March, April, and May.
Right.
So check your calendar listings, ladies and gentlemen. Check the website, lannan.org. Patrick Lannan, president of the Lannan Foundation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Take care.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.